Hi, Killjoys. It's Rachel and Melody here, and we are just popping in to say that we actually have a special bonus episode this week that's brought to us by our friends at the Pacific Northwest College of Art. We will be back next week for Witch Month with more witchy goodness. But first, Melody, tell us about our sponsor for today.
This podcast is sponsored by PNCA, more specifically the MA in Critical Studies program, because we need to interrogate, intervene, and reimagine like never before. For more information or to apply, you should visit pnca.edu/criticalstudies. And also, I think in our interview, we interrogate, intervene, and reimagine all of our discussions with our very special interview guest. So this is all such a weave together wonderful episode that is not witchy, but I wonder if the identifies as a witch. We never asked her. I'm rambling. Let's go. You're listening to Feminist Killjoys, an hour of feminism, pop culture, and politics as discussed by two professional killjoys.
I'm Rachel.
And I'm Melody.
And today, we sit down with fellow Killjoy, Dr. Z. Nicolazzo, to discuss being a transgender student in higher education, being a transgender professor, and being somebody who's really thoughtful about methodology. We get really nerdy and deep about methods, which is great. And we discuss so many other things. But first, Mel, how is it going?
How is it going? It is going good. I listened.
My impersonation of you. You love when people have upspeak.
I do. All of my favorite podcast hosts do that, too. Speaking of podcasts, my partner is on a road trip right now to North Dakota, and so he was downloading a bunch of podcasts, and so I was going through which ones from, like, our podcasts that he should listen to. Mm-hmm. He's not a weekly listener because he starts listening to it during our check-ins, and then he gets bored because he's like, she just told me this, like, or she'll be like, she stole that from me. That was my joke. And so he, like, saves them up. And he's also very particular about how he listens to podcasts. At any rate, so I started listening to some of ours so I could remember which ones to suggest to him. And I feel like when we're recording, I'm like, no, it's fine. Or, like, get to the next question. Or I'm babbling. Like, all this stuff's going on in my head. But then when I listen to the finished product, I'm like, oh, we're pretty entertaining. Like, this is enjoyable to listen to. So I had a little, like, self-boost of esteem.
Love it.
This morning. You know how it is.
I do. Yeah. We got to fight that imposter syndrome anytime we can.
Otherwise, things are good. I mean, there's so much shitty shit going on in the world that, like, did you follow a lot of this is going to be a blended check-in now. Did you follow much of the stuff about Brett Kavanaugh over the weekend with a vote?
I mean, I knew it was happening. I had basically, like, the bulk of my check-in was that my partner's parents were in town, partly for an engagement party for our friend Angela, who they're close with. So it was just a busy weekend. So thankfully I wasn't, again, I sort of had reasons not to be on the internet, but I, you know, I knew it was all happening. So yeah, more shittiness related to that, obviously. But was there something sort of specific you were thinking about?
Well, I just noticed, I'm just curious if the people, this is like media effects-y kind of analysis, but it feels like the people that were on the internet a lot, which was not me either, were reporting, like, feeling just like god awful about it and just demoralized. And I am too, but I felt much more separated from it. And maybe it's just a coping mechanism because I'm not wanting to sit with it, but it's like, what's going to happen if I sit with it? So I was just wondering if there's a difference of people that, you know, when they follow along on social media, on Twitter, that they have a more visceral reaction than those of us that were able to kind of disconnect this weekend, which is a privilege we have, of course.
Yeah.
That's why I was wondering. I was just kind of curious what your reaction was, but yeah. It seemed like we kind of missed the weekend away.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think this came up with us when we talked about it last week when, like, Thursday, it sounded like both of us were kind of, other than teaching, we both teach on Thursdays, but like in between classes, I was like following along on Twitter and, you know, listening to everything that was happening with the testimony. This was now, I guess, 2 weeks ago at this point. But then we talked about how when we met up on Friday and like weren't by our computers at all day, like it was just so I think that it's like, that's just an anecdotal study, but I think that that's probably very true that if you're not following along on the internet, you're better able to sort of compartmentalize, I guess.
But then also, truth be told, I got the Sunday Times yesterday, as you do as well. Mm-hmm. And the front cover was plastered with Kavanaugh news.
Yeah.
And I read like just a little bit. So I knew the W's, right, like the basic right stuff. I did not go down that hole because it's like, I'm just going to get infuriated. And I don't want to say there's nothing I can do. We can all vote. We should all register to vote and vote if that is in your political alignment to vote. With this case, it's like, there's nothing I can do.
Right.
So I'm going to sit here and get fucking pissed. And for what? You know, like, I need to spend my energy on something else today. We're not saying that if you are super pissed and angry that's, you know, of course, please expend that energy. I'm just noticing different people's different reactions to it. And I'm just curious if it has anything to do with our immersion into media. That's
yeah
all.
Yeah. I mean, I think it does. I also think it's like, we talked about this a lot with Trump too. It's also like, there are so many people who feel the weight of deep oppression, regardless of who's on the Supreme Court and who's president and who's, you know, all of these other things. And so even though this is going to have, you know, tangible consequences, there's still like this Howard Zinn quote was circulating about how like change doesn't happen in the level of the Supreme Court. That's very naive to think that. Change happens with movements on the street, with, you know, with from the bottom up, not the top down. So that's always like, that's both like discouraging because we can't, you know, it's not, we can't just vote the right people into office, at least in my opinion, to help, you know, make things actually better. But it does mean that we do still have power on the ground to create the society we want to create, even amidst the harder battles that we'll have with this new face of the highest court in the land.
If I may, for like 30 seconds,
yeah,
respond to Howard Zinn. I feel like that quote is usually helpful. I think given that the Supreme Court recently like had some pretty big rulings, one of them same-sex marriage, and I know that there's a lot of people in the LGBTQ plus A community that don't think that gay marriage is the way to equality, but they did put through a huge societal shift.
Yeah, but Mel, that was because of the social movements on the ground that pushed them there. You know what I mean?
Got it. Okay, I see how it's all connected.
You see?
Yes.
Yeah. So I think that's the kernel of hope. Like that would not have happened if there hadn't been decades and decades of LGBTQ struggle.
Okay. Fair. I was just seeing it as an either or thing. Okay.
Yeah. No, it's both. It's always both and, you know, sometimes I have extreme rhetoric if people didn't notice.
Oh, really? Both and is our word of the week too. All of our interview people that
had
you will
some
hear.
Both and, it's true, yeah.
They all said both and now you said both and.
Yeah.
It's like Pee Wee Herman, you have to scream when we say both and.
It's also like so unsatisfying in some ways, but it's also just like mostly usually how it is. So anyway.
And helpful. It's fine. Everything's fine, Rachel. There's nothing, everything's great. There's no problems.
Good.
Do you have other things, though? I kind of just took over with the Brett Kavanaugh analysis.
My partner's parents were in town. The engagement party was nice. There was a fall bonfire, which I love.
Very folly.
Very folly. Yeah, it was very folly. But, you know, the next day when you smell like a bonfire, it's kind of rough. There are far worse things in the world, but that was something that happened. But this is an exciting thing. I haven't even told you this. This is live exciting news for you. I'm taking Spanish class in a community ed program.
Bueno, mi amiga.
Sí.
Boop, 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 boop. Tell me more.
It's an 8-week community ed Spanish one class. And
awesome.
Yeah, Logan and I are both taking it. So we just go to like a local public school around the corner from us.
These are so fun.
Yeah. I know you've done that. You did that with Somali, didn't you?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So it's been great. And the teacher is from Venezuela. And did I say that really weird? Venezuela.
Yeah, you did.
Venezuela. Venezuela.
Like I've never heard of that. Cool.
And he was speaking in Spanish the entire time. Like, and some of the, like, an older white couple was like, we thought this was Spanish one. And he just like answered them in Spanish and like was not letting up. Which is great, you know, because like immersion is, you know, the best way to learn. So I'm super excited because it's, I mean, I learned Spanish in bits and chunks when I have had the deep privilege of traveling to Latin American countries, but I've never taken it like formally. So I'm, and it's long overdue. It's something that feels really important to me given the just, I don't know, yep. nature of the way I want to be in the world. I don't know, the work that I'm mm-hmm. interested in.
Mm-hmm. Do you know yeah. about the app Duolingo?
Yeah, I have it. So that, yep.
Oh, good.
So I've been using it.
That I learned a lot. That's how I learned a lot of my Spanish, actually. I've been wanting to take a class like you and Logan are taking.
Yeah.
But I feel like Duolingo is like super, super helpful too.
It's great. I was going to say, I feel like I'm so good at reading it. But speaking it, I'm like, even just trying to engage with you when you started like saying Spanish words, I was like, oh no, I can't say anything out loud yet. So I feel like my comprehension is really good, but speaking is still really tough.
Oh, great. And that'll be helpful though, because Logan's taking it so you both can practice because Dakota knows Spanish. So mm-hmm. if I'm practicing something on Duolingo, then I can say it to him in Spanish.
Right.
And then he either says, he looks at me like I'm speaking not Spanish or you know, helps me. He helps me. So it's good to have another person. You're right. To be able to speak it with. So
yeah, we have a great interview to get to. Just a second reminder that because this is like a bonus up, we're back with our regularly scheduled Witch Week next week. But first, Mel, do you want to tell the good listeners who we're about to talk to?
Yeah. So we interviewed this amazing scholar, Dr. Z. Nicolazzo, and her pronouns are she, her, or Z here. So we use those interchangeably. She is an assistant professor of trans studies in education in the Center for the Study of Higher Education at the University of Arizona. She's also a member of the Trans Studies Initiative at UA, an interdisciplinary group of trans scholars dedicated to furthering the growing discipline of transgender studies. You can follow her on Twitter at @trans_killjoy. Ba-da-da-da. And also, Dr. Z is talking at PNCA.
Yes. So one reason that we wanted to air this week in the midst of Witch Month was because we really want to promote an amazing workshop that Z is doing at PNCA. Z is hosting a workshop at the Pedagogy Engage, Critique, Inspire Symposium that PNCA is hosting October 12th and 13th. So if you are lucky enough to be in Portland for this, we highly, highly recommend you go. So Z's workshop is at 11:45 on the 13th. So Z's talk is called Teaching While Marginalized, What Our Bodies Teach Us About Critical Pedagogy. And it's going to be very workshop oriented. So not just a talk, it'll be interactive. And so it's going to be amazing. So any of our listeners in Portland or any surrounding area, highly, highly recommend that you get there. So, and I think you're going to definitely want to go, especially after you hear this talk. Melody, will you take us there?
Welcome, Z, to Feminist Killjoy's PhD. Our first question for you is a thematic one because your Twitter handle is trans_killjoy. So clearly you are in the culture of the killjoys. So since we share a similar affinity to the word, would you mind explaining to us and the listeners what you mean when you say that you are a killjoy or what killjoy means to you?
Yeah, sure. So thanks for having me on the podcast. Longtime listener, first time caller, I guess. So for me, the notion of a killjoy really stems from Sarah Ahmed's work. And I think about it as being the person that will always bring up trans issues and trans people and will always be the one that kind of talks about that in particular spaces. So for me, it's educational contexts. And usually that sucks the air out of rooms, and that might make people uncomfortable, and that might make non-trans people have all sorts of feelings, but it isn't something that stops me. And so that's what I think of when I think about being a trans killjoy, that person that will always bring up trans people, trans issues, and trans perspectives as a way to make more gender expansive climates in education, regardless of the feelings that might be brought up for non-trans people.
That's amazing. That's a great answer. Speaking of that, your book that came out in 2017, Trans in College, Transgender Student Strategies for Navigating Campus Life and the Institutional Politics of Inclusion, was based on your dissertation research, which we might get to in a minute, right? Is that mm-hmm. correct? Right. So can you tell us generally what you're arguing and revealing in the book?
Yeah, sure. So I often joke that my dissertation grew up and became the book, Trans in College. And what I'm trying to do through the book is a couple different things. The first is that I'm trying to really talk about cultural discourses of gender and how those play out on college campuses. So I took as my starting place Stephen Whittle's introduction in the first Transgender Studies Reader, which was published in 2006. And in that introduction, he said that there was more and more visibility socially of transgender people. He makes this comment about if you type in transgender to a Google search, you'll get an increasing number of hits and news articles, which is certainly true. And yet, there wasn't a whole lot being done in thinking about trans students on college campuses. So I talk about kind of this paradoxical nature of increasing visibility socially, and we can talk about whether or not that visibility has, how that visibility has worked or hasn't worked in terms of creating safety for trans people. But then also this kind of absence or silence around trans people in colleges. So I wanted to kind of think about how is it that broader cultural discourses of gender are mediating trans student experiences on college campuses. And then also to try and create a counter story or a counter narrative to this largely deficit-based framing that has been happening or was happening prior to the book when we thought about trans people writ large, right? So the little that was being written about trans people in colleges was really focused on how trans students aren't living up to or matching their non-trans peers in terms of things like engagement and leadership and persistence and graduation. And so what I wanted to try and do with this book is flip that script and think about how is it that trans people are developing and maintaining community and are able to navigate their institutions, all while knowing that these institutions were never built with us in mind to begin with. And so, I think those are kind of like the dual purposes of the book, and really to try and center the students themselves, right? And to allow them to be the narrators of their own life rather than other people kind of pontificating or placing things onto them and their experiences.
That sounds wonderful. And I've already sent your book, like I've let two colleagues know about your book already, and they're really excited to check it out because I think it's really helpful. I think what you were just saying about how it's often on the discussions on the administration side or on the professor side, and oftentimes we don't hear the student voices. And so when we're in these meetings discussing student success, we often lack these student voices. So I think that's super important. So thank you. Thank you for your work, because I think it's huge and really helpful. So more about the book, though, is your methodology. So Rachel and I are super into methodology. We both have done ethnographies ourselves. We took feminist methodology classes, so we love nerding out about this kind of stuff. So can you tell us a little bit about your research methods behind your book and your dissertation, and then the challenges and the questions that you had studying, so in quotes, studying trans college students?
Yeah, well, I mean, we're just in great company because I love nerding out about methodology as well. So the particular ethnographic methodology that I used is something called critical collaborative ethnography. It differs from participatory action research in the sense that I did not come up with the purpose of the study, the research questions, and kind of the framing and delivery of the study with participants. But the idea with critical collaborative ethnography is it's a deeply feminist practice where basically you think about your research not being on or about a population, but being with and alongside of a population. So the participants in large part were very much drivers of this research project. I would constantly be asking them, who should I be talking with? Where should I be going? What events should I be attending? I was really trying to allow them to be in the forefront of this work and for us to kind of think about ourselves as doing this side by side rather than me as the expert coming in, collecting data and then leaving, or what RIST refers to as blitzkrieg ethnography. So really trying to kind of push that practice away and think about even using the language of participants sometimes sounds very odd to me, because these folks, yes, were participants in a research study, but also became advocates for me, confidants, friends. They became mentors and mentees. I think that the way we were able to develop our relationship was it moved beyond the idea of participant or interlocutor and researcher. And so that was some of the stuff that happened during the study. I think what happened as the study was concluding and after the study also is important to think about when we think about methodology. I heard story after story from these participants about how they didn't really have trans elders to be in community with, that alongside of me and Tristan, who was one of the gatekeepers, one of the staff members at City University, aside from the two of us, they really didn't know any other trans folks or any kind of possibility models. And so I started realizing that the idea of quote unquote leaving the field was deeply problematic and had a lot of ethical cuts to it. And so for me, doing critical collaborative ethnography means that maybe I even at this point haven't really left the field because I'm still deeply connected with many of the participants over virtual platforms like Instagram and Twitter, Facebook. I've, you know, when I got my advanced copies of the book, I sent them to participants, you know, so we still are in community, even though the study finished, gosh, almost 4 years ago at this point. And so when I think about kind of a collaborative ethnographic project, I really am trying to think about how does that extend beyond data collection and what are the implications or things that we need to be thinking about in terms of when we quote unquote end our projects, if that makes sense.
It makes total sense. I appreciate that so much. Melody and I both, Mel, if I remember correctly, we both sent chapters that we'd written about, you know, folks that we'd been sort of research, quote unquote, researching, but really collaborating with, I think, in a similar way that you're describing, and had them read that. Is that right, Melody? You sent your chapters to sometimes, right?
Like before it got published?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. But yeah. But I like what Z was saying about the continued community. I feel like I haven't been able to put words to that, but that's exactly what's been happening after my book came out, that the people that I talked with and worked with for my project, we're still in community, and we've actually gotten to know each other even better after my study. I totally subscribe to all of that good methodology stuff, sending books, my copy of books to people and all that stuff. So
I was gonna say, it's like, it was this really strange kind of thing for me because I knew that I would be thinking about and studying community as a part of the research, but I guess I didn't realize that I was kind of implicated in that community building project until participants started requesting to be my friend on Facebook. Mm-hmm. And then I thought to myself, oh my gosh, we've broken the fourth wall here, right? Like there's something happening that is very, it's a little meta in a sense, but thinking about building community while also studying community. And so, you know, like I wasn't prepared to kind of handle or answer these questions or really think through them and had to do it on the fly because most of, and I would probably venture to say most of our methods is were really kind of focused on data collection and analysis. They weren't really thinking about, well, here are some different things that we need to think about if we're working alongside of marginalized populations or within populations that we ourselves are a part of.
Exactly. Yeah. I just think this did come up thankfully because Melody and I took a feminist methodologies class. This kind of stuff did come up. And I think it's very queer and very feminist to acknowledge that you can't not build like actual relationships with people that you're working, you know, with ultimately with. And yeah, same thing. Like I got connected with folks that I was working or that, you know, again, quote unquote, studying on social media and have built, same thing, built friendships, partly because like, I don't know, when you meet cool queer people, like, how are you not going to be friends with them?
Right.
That's how I felt anyway. Well, we could go on about methodology, but we'll move on. I would love to hear more about your discussion of affirmative and resilience-based approaches, which you touched on a bit, sort of flipping the script about, you know, not emphasizing the fact that they're not sort of catching up to their cisgender peers. Mm-hmm. So can you sort of expand on that? And also in addressing that, we'd love to hear about the sort of the ways that you addressed intersections of race and disability and class and all of the other things that, of course, impact the way that trans students walk through the world.
Yeah. So the theoretical perspective that I used for this study is it's called Critical Trans Politics, and it comes from a book called Normal Life by Dean Spade, which if folks have not read that book, please, please do.
We recommend that all the time, so yeah. I hope they have.
Dean Spade is just a wonderful critical legal scholar and co-founder of the Sylvia Rivera Law Project. And so his book, Critical Trans Politics, is very much a branch of critical race theory. So he's making this argument through critical trans politics for what he calls trickle-up activism, and this idea that we focus on the most vulnerable populations, and through trying to work towards rights and access for that population, we actually create access for various marginalized populations. So it's very much kind of this way of thinking across populations, right? This movement building across populations rather than just saying, well, I'm doing this work for trans people and then other people can do work for people of color, as if the two communities don't have lots and lots of overlap, right? And so I was using this particular theoretical framework in the study and for the book to really think about how is it that trans people are already recreating the environments that they need in higher education to be able to be successful, however it is they define that term. Because if we don't think about the ways that trans students are doing what they need to do already, then what we're essentially saying is that we as educators are just waiting around for non-trans administrators to save trans kids. And we're stripping trans students of their agency, as well as kind of being really ahistorical, right? We're not recognizing that trans people have always been active in creating the futures and worlds that we need rather than dealing with the ones that we have. So that's what I was trying to do with an affirmative and resilience-based approach. I think the difficulty sometimes is that because we live in an either-or world, right, where people want to think that things are either one way or another, some people tend to struggle kind of thinking about the nuance that things can be both good and bad at the same time, that trans students can be both able to practice forms of resilience and also can bump into all sorts of problems and have lots of difficulty. So this isn't a narrative about trans students being heroes or overcoming all of the bad stuff and then never facing it again, but it's trying to flip that script and create a little bit more of a nuanced understanding of how they try to create what I call practices of resilience, some of which work, some of which don't, and how it is that their various identities and subjectivities influence their ability to navigate this space that we call college.
I had a follow-up question to all of that, and that was, actually, let me ask a clarifying question. In your study, what kind of college students were you working with?
So, yeah, it's a great question. I was working with students at one four-year institution, which actually is kind of driving my thinking about some future studies. So that's kind of one critique I have of my book, is that it's just focused on four-year institutions. The student population themselves, the participants, two of the nine were Black, the rest were white. There were various different disabilities that students had across race, and there was quite a bit of difference in terms of socioeconomic status as well within the participant pool. And one student identified as Jewish. And so some diversity within the sample, some things that I would have liked to have more diversity with, but I think I got a very different narrative at City University than I would have gotten had I done the study at Miami, which was my doctoral institution.
I was asking because both Rachel and I are teaching at a community college right now.
Mm-hmm.
And so even if it's not based on what you found in your book, because I would not say that it's a critique. I mean, I think we're very critical of ourselves, but the fact that you engaged with trans students and did that intense ethnography is amazing, and you can't do everything in one study. But because of our position intersectionality. Have you heard, like in your research or your readings, like any differences with trans students' resiliency, success across different types of colleges?
Yeah, so this is where some of my work is tracking, as well as one of the students whose dissertation committee is I'm doing right now. She is going to be looking at trans students at community colleges. She's also a teacher at a community college, and so is really thinking about trans students there, which is super great. And so that will come out in the next couple of years. The other work that I'm trying to do is thinking about trans students at various different institutional types. In particular, this one project I'm working on getting funding for is focused on trans women of color. And we know, I mean, the two of you probably know very intimately that community colleges, technical colleges, profit institutions, vocational certificate programs, right, all this kind of stuff, these educational spaces tend to be far more pluralistic. And so my guess is that there would be more trans students at these institutions. My other guess is that because a lot of these institutions are not necessarily residential, that trans students are operating differently in those spaces. You know, there are a number of students through the work that I've done and some other trans educators have done highlight the fact that our participants are actually moving away from the college campus, the four-year college campus, as a way to, as a intentional strategy to navigate their college campus. So they're going into the community. They're Sylvia, one of my participants, studied abroad for a year because she just didn't want to deal with the realities of City University anymore. They're taking classes online. And so I'm wondering how being at a community or a technical college might shift these practices of resilience, particularly because of the lack of, I think, focus, or maybe the lack of kind of the physical campus being a central facet of institutional life, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, I think in some ways there is this level of sort of, you can choose sort of a higher level of anonymity at a community college. You can just sort of show up, you know, go to your class and then leave. And that might create a level of actually comfort compared to like having to navigate the dorm, for example. That said, it also is less likely that you're going to, you know, find community in the LGBT group, you know, on campus, et cetera. So I could see it being, you know, having pros and cons, I suppose, given, given everything. So yeah, that's interesting. Yeah. I'm glad that that there's research about that coming out soon too.
So our next question is actually flows very nicely from what we were just talking about working at different colleges, is that you created or curated an open source trans studies in higher ed syllabus, which is amazing.
Oh,
so for listeners, you should definitely check it out. So we have a lot of educators that listen. And even if people are interested in just learning more about what we're talking about, I think the syllabus is really awesome. One of the first resources is from Dean Spade, and it's, I think it's like 12 different ways that you can be supportive of trans students in college. I hate to butcher the title, but lots of practical suggestions and advice for educators, students, allies within these documents. So could you talk a little bit more about the syllabus, but also could you talk a little bit about the issues of labor, you producing it, and what the issues are around trans people producing all this labor and how the syllabus is a response to it?
There's a little bit of an origin story at the beginning of the syllabus when folks check it out. But the short version is that I kept on being asked to give non-trans people resources about trans folks. Hey, can you send me this resource? Hey, I'm looking for stuff about this. Can you share resources? And I was thinking to myself, about the exhausting nature of that kind of labor, where someone was literally emailing me to ask them to Google stuff for them, and that was happening regularly, and not just with students or not just with early career researchers. I mean, people that are tenured and lead equity-based research centers and probably should know better were also asking me that question. So I was thinking about that reality, as well as the fact that that question actually erases the ongoing labor that me and my trans, mostly trans, but not exclusively trans peers have been doing for years to kind of fill some chasms around empirical literature focused on trans people, trans educators, trans students in post-secondary education contexts. And so on one hand, they're kind of saying, oh, I want to do better, and so help me do better. But on the other hand, they're actually not doing better. It almost acts like one of Sarah Ahmed's non-performatives, right? Because they're kind of not doing better by just getting me to do it for them and refusing to acknowledge the work that me and my colleagues have been doing. And so I got a little fed up one summer and decided that I had the capacity to kind of build this syllabus, and that hopefully this syllabus could be a resource that people could just very quickly and easily send out to folks, so that myself and other trans folks would not have to do this ongoing labor and have to deal with this ongoing erasure of the work that we've been doing. And so literally it is, I mean, very much, it's a 16-week syllabus, because as I tell my students, or as I tell people as I'm talking about this syllabus, we don't take breaks when it comes to gender awareness. So there's no like break for conferences or break for like, you know, a holiday. And it is everything from resources for definitions. So I provide resources where there are glossaries. I provide all sorts of articles about definitions, which is a constant question that I receive. Melody, like you said, one of the first articles is that beautiful piece by Dean Spade in Radical Teacher about very easy and practical things that people can do, literally that you can change like tomorrow in your practice, down to thinking about trans feminisms, to trans people of color, to there is an entire week of the syllabus just with people to follow, trans people to follow on social media, trans activists, artists, educators, speakers, poets. So people can think about if they want to bring someone to their campus, there's a whole list of folks that they can bring to their campus. There's a whole list of people that they can follow on Twitter and gain more knowledge from, so that we see this as an ongoing practice rather than, well, I learned about trans people because Jamie's the Third came to my campus and spit some poetry and I'm done and I can check that off my list. Mm-hmm. Right? So my hope is, and it has, you know, come true for the most part, that this is a living document and something that I'm continually updating and taking emails from folks who want to send me stuff to throw on there as well, so that it can continue to be kind of a central hub.
That's so great. And I hope that, we'll make sure we put it in the show notes and in our newsletter, but I really hope that everybody goes and seeks that out if they don't see that there. It's an amazing, amazing resource. I have a kind of a very specific follow-up question, and I feel like I've heard a lot of debate around it. So this is just like a very sort of small practical thing that happens in classrooms. How do you personally feel what did you discover from the students that you worked with about doing pronouns like on the first day of class?
This is really an ongoing conversation that I have with a lot of my trans colleagues. You know, I think in very typical Z fashion, I think it can be like a both and, right? It can be both a really important practice, I think symbolically and otherwise, to allow people to kind of be present in ways that they want to and feel comfortable and safe being present. I sometimes worry, though, that the sharing of pronouns is really decontextualized. So a lot of people, especially in higher ed, are doing this, but they don't really know why they're doing it, or they don't really know what it's about. And so people often say like, oh, well, I've included my pronouns in my email signature. And I think to them, I say, you know, I think that's really great. I wonder if, because it's an online kind of medium, if we could hyperlink to a page that talks about why pronouns are important, right? Which a number of people have been doing, and I certainly do in my email signature, because I think it actually gives a little bit of understanding of why we're doing pronouns. So if and when I do those at the start of class, I always invite people to share what they think is important for other people to know about them at that particular time, because I never want to make students feel pressure to share pieces of themselves that they might feel uncomfortable or unsafe doing. I also write something into my syllabus saying that if you want to change the name that you go by or the pronouns that you use at any point in the semester, let me know and we can develop plans for how to share that with other students if you'd like to do that. And then I usually make some kind of statement about my own pronouns because the pronouns that I use are either very strange for students. So one set of pronouns that I use are Z and here, which certainly marks me as a trans person of a certain age. I don't think they're as kind of in vogue now. But I also use she and her pronouns, which don't necessarily stick to my body in the ways that some people think. And so I tell students, you know, I will do my best to try and remember your pronouns, which might not be the pronouns that I always use with myself and in my group of friends. And I anticipate and hope that you folks will try your best to remember my pronouns. And so it's almost like this like ethnographic modeling of reminding people that what's familiar for them might be strange for others and vice versa. So yeah, I mean, I think it can be a good practice. I just wonder about the intentionality and the contextualizing of it, I guess.
Yeah, I think that's a great response. And yeah, it always feels a lot easier for me when I'm teaching an explicitly gender, or like when I, because I've taught in women's studies departments as well as comm departments. Mm-hmm. And when it's a gender class, it feels like so easy to provide that context. And it always feels a little bit more challenging. I mean, obviously, all my classes are going to talk about these kinds of questions, but it just feels a little bit like a, I'm going to give you this like super big thing that many of you have never heard of. And I'm going to sort of potentially out a bunch of students, you know, or not a bunch, mm-hmm. rather like a very, very small possibly number of students. And yeah. I've just wrestled with it. And I appreciate that response and the labor you took me to give it.
So just two things, just thinking about the educators that might be listening. If you do pronoun go arounds, I would really suggest reading that Dean Spade article in Radical Teacher, because one thing that Dean Spade suggests is, you know, you don't even have to do the pronoun go around thing, but the idea of don't call the students' names off of a roster. You let mm-hmm. them say their names first, which is what I do in my classes too. And it gets tricky though. And so this is just like a tip or trick for people listening. It gets tricky, especially with online courses and digital rosters, where people's names that are on the rosters are not the names that they go by. And mm-hmm. I've learned in my school that they can, it's very easy to change your name that's, you know, associated with your roster. It doesn't have to be your legal name. You can just do it through, at least through my community college. If my community college does it, I'm assuming your school does too. But it's really important to get that paperwork, help the student fill it out, because there's a lot of anxiety that goes into, you know, going up to the desk and talking with somebody who they don't know and asking them to change a name that record, like in records wise, takes not that much time, but you'd be amazed at the barriers. So like my student, one student who needed to change his name on the roster and on the online teaching platform, the IT people kept saying, well, it's better if you wait till the end of the semester to change your email name. And I'm like, I think that's a bunch of BS. And I called mm-hmm. my IT friend and he changed it within 5 minutes, you know? And mm-hmm. so to continually be that kind of advocate and think about stuff like that, about helping people change their names within the system. Like if you're a professor or a faculty member, you have a lot of power. And so to use that power to help these students, because even if they, you know, perform resiliency, they are resilient, they are empowered, they still run up against barriers that make them avoid doing things as simple as empowering as changing their name on a roster. So I just wanted to throw out that tip as well.
Yeah. And we could certainly, you know, have a laundry list of a bunch of other questions, but that's why we want to send people toward your book and toward the syllabus. So I'm sure people listening have other questions, but please go read all of those things that we just mentioned. So to sort of close out, we are super excited that this is going to be released the same week that you'll be speaking at Pacific Northwest College of Art. They're sort of friends of the show. We've worked with them before and we have a lot of love for Portland, even though neither of us live there. So anyway, if people are in Portland, Oregon, they should come see you on October 13th, right? Or is it the 12th? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's Saturday. I think it's the 13th. Yeah.
13th. Okay. Yeah. Yep. It looks like 11:45 a.m. So you're teaching this workshop, or leading a workshop rather, called Teaching While Marginalized, What Our Bodies Teach Us About Critical Pedagogy. So can you sort of summarize what that is going to involve and what people can expect if they are lucky enough to attend?
Yeah. I am super excited to be going, really thrilled to have been asked to come facilitate. And what I'm going to be doing is I'm actually going to be picking up on some autoethnographic work that I did last year with a trans colleague of mine, Dr. Katie Jekyll, who, you know, trans folks don't often, at least in the faculty realm, don't often get to say this, but it was really great to work alongside Katie in Illinois because we weren't the only ones. We were actually in the same department, which is a super duper gift. And so we did some thinking about what was happening through our teaching practice and how we were kind of made and unmade by our students and by our colleagues and in our kind of professorial lives, and tried to kind of make sense of that. You know, there were always these times where we would kind of check in with each other after classes or after meetings and say, like, did you hear what I heard? And are you experiencing things in the same way? And how is this showing up? And, you know, for Katie being masculine of center, for myself being trans femme, we were just trying to like match notes and figure all this stuff out. And so we started thinking about this notion that we call teaching trans and how teaching and really critical pedagogy is an embodied practice, and that we were always teaching about gender, even if we weren't teaching gender-based courses. So the workshop will be kind of picking up on this idea of embodied pedagogy, of being mindful of who we are and how that might mediate our experiences, as well as different strategies and ideas that we can develop as a group in the true nature of a facilitated workshop. Certainly will not be lecture-based, but thinking about the participants who are there, the audience members who are there, thinking about their own localized experience, their own kind of historical trajectories as educators, and then what are some things that we can develop together to think about how we can be thoughtful around teaching from marginalized positionalities, especially as there are varying different levels of precarity that will very much be in the room, right? So I'm sure that there will be some folks with tenure. I'm sure there will be some folks that are pre-tenure. I'm sure there will be adjunct folks and people not on tenure track lines. And also, I'm sure, a lot of graduate students and teaching assistants. And so trying to think about how we can be mindful of embodied pedagogy and kind of come together to develop some strategies for navigating the complexities of that all.
I really wish I could be there. That sounds so good. That sounds so good. Mel, sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off.
How do you always know when I'm going to talk? You have witch spirits.
Like some weird psychic thing that you all have.
Yeah, well, when you do the podcast.
Witchy sister, yeah, it's true.
You do a podcast for like 100 plus episodes, we get used to our silent mannerisms, nonverbals. Geez, I was going to say that I just bought my plane ticket to Portland to watch that. And because I have $1 million. And if people can't make it, is there any kind of like web-based, are you going to record it, podcast, web-based stuff, anything people could check out otherwise?
I don't know. I would have to touch base with Shauna about that.
Okay. If there is, we'll be sure to tell our listeners.
Yeah.
So as our final question for you, no promises there on the final, though. Where can people find you? So we heard about your book, we heard about your syllabus, but where else can people check you out on the internet?
Where do you want people to buy your book?
Because I have a question about that, too.
It's getting harder and harder for me to stomach. I don't always, sometimes I'm like, okay, I'm ordering from Amazon. I know it's not great, but I'm just going to do it. But it's getting harder and harder for me to do that. So where should I buy your book? We all buy your book instead of Amazon.
Yeah, so instead of Amazon, you can buy it on the Stylus Publishing website. So you can just type into your little Google machine, Stylus Publishing, Trans in College, and the book should just pop up. So that's an option of where to get it. And then I live on the internet largely on Twitter. So trans_Killjoy is the handle. I'm also on, I'm back on Facebook after probably a 3 or 4 year hiatus. So I am Doc Z Nicolazzo on Facebook because, you know, Facebook won't allow me to have a one letter first name. And yeah, I mean, I think those are the places that I'm most active. I also have a website. So I just need to go ahead and pay for this website rather than doing the free site. But at this point, it's znicolazzo.weebly.com. And you can see some of the things that I've been up to, places that have been going. I have a blog that I post to not regularly enough. But yeah, those are the spaces where people can hang out with me on the internet.
Awesome.
So I have a follow-up question about the Amazon situation because I was ordering your book on Stylus and then it had me connect to Amazon Pay.
Oh, interesting. I guess you're right. I'm wondering if that's like a, I'm assuming that Amazon probably gets some profit from that.
So I tried to avoid the Amazon wheel, but just for people who are going to also order it via Stylus, because I was thinking the same thing. I was like, wait, I'm like, I'll still do this, but I'm still connecting to Amazon. So what's the difference? So I wanted to ask about that anyways.
I was going to say, everybody go to your local bookstore and ask them to order it. And then
there you go. There's the solution. Yeah. Thank you, Rachel.
Go to your favorite feminist bookstore.
Yep.
Moon Palace
in Minneapolis. Cool. We totally lied about asking you. No more questions. Because we would love for you to stick around with us and join us for RWL to share what you are reading, watching, and listening to this week.
Would love to.
Yay!
Reading, watching, and listening with Rachel, Melody, and Z. Thank you. So I'm reading Creative Commons stuff. I'm taking an online class. I don't know if I told you this, Rachel. I'm taking an online class to get Creative Commons certified.
I didn't know that. That's great.
Yeah, I'm a Lawrence Lessig, I guess, scholar now. But anyways, I'm getting licensed in Creative Commons, so it's like kind of an anti-copyright situation. I'm reading about Creative Commons and copyright law. Really good nerdy stuff. I'm watching a new show on NBC called Manifest. Anybody?
I've heard of it. Is it good?
It's like Lost, except it's a plane goes missing for 5 years, but the people on the plane feel like they were only on the plane for 3 hours. So when they land, everybody's freaking out because they've been missing for 5 years. So it's just one of those like mystery sci-fi things. I don't know. Just something crappy TV to watch in the fall with a good solid feminist female lead. So I'm into that. And then I'm listening to this podcast called How Sound. It's produced by PRX and it's really about podcast audio quality. So I'm a giant nerd. Okay, Rachel, your turn.
So I'm reading the same book that I talked about last, which is Joyful Militancy. My partner gets the New York Times on Sunday, so I was reading it. And there was this interview with Jane Fonda, who is more and more just like my favorite person in the world. And I just want to read one blurb from her interview. Oh, I just love her so much. So she's getting interviewed by the New York Times because there's this movie about her on HBO right now. And the interviewer says, "What's the focus of your activism today?" And she says, "Grassroots organizing, the organizations that are going door to door and helping people understand that the white working class is not the enemy of people of color and vice versa, that we have to stand together against a common enemy, which is that people only care about money and power and don't give a hoot about average Americans." And I was just like, Jane Fonda, talk to me about common enemies like all you want. And let's like talk about how your eyelashes are still so great and makeup tips. And I just love you so much. So I just really love Jane Fonda. She's so femme and amazing and has been crushing it as a celebrity activist in a way better way than most celebrity activists. You know, she like actually cares about capitalism. So anyway, Jane Fonda interview. Watching, I have nothing to show. I'm watching my students make their movies. I'm really enjoying teaching a film production class. It's been really scary because I hadn't taught it before, but they just started shooting their first films yesterday, and it was really, really fun to watch them work together and create that. Listening is, has anybody heard? Okay, first of all, Melody, you listen to The Heart. Z, do you know what The Heart is, the podcast?
No, I haven't listened to it.
Oh, it's so good. So that's a great podcast by this person named Caitlin Prest, and they stopped making The Heart, but now they have a new podcast called The Shadows. and it's very, very, very good. So that's what I'm listening to.
I'm pulling it up on my phone as we speak. So, fun fact about Jane Fonda. My colleagues a couple of weeks ago hosted a like decades party where they encouraged everyone to dress up, and I dressed up as 1980s workout video Jane Fonda realness.
Amazing. So, yeah. Look at that synchronicity. I love that.
I should have sent you one of those pictures for the promos. I mean, it's yes. probably not too late, but yeah.
It's not. It's not too late.
I am reading two incredible books. So I just finished The Hate U Give, which is just a beautiful and very intense novel. I wanted to read it before I go to see the movie. And I'm also reading Tay Meadows' book, Trans Kids, which is a lovely ethnography about how trans youth are gendered and kind of how gender mediator kind of operates through medical and educational institutions for trans kids. What I am watching these days, I cannot seem to quit Grey's Anatomy, even though sometimes I try, and even though I don't like Owen Hunt, and I don't think anyone does, but anyway, that's my own thing. Been watching Grey's, and also I'm kind of a little nerding out over The Good Place.
Yes.
Yeah. So as a former philosophy undergraduate student, I just, The Good Place brings me back to like some really wonderful philosophical conversations that I also think are just really important at this point in time, thinking about humanity and kindness and all this kind of stuff. So, yeah, kind of like a silly little show, but like I apparently invest way too much analytical kind of thought into it. And then I am listening to the third season of the Serial podcast, which is yes. basically a year in the life of Cleveland courtrooms, which is fascinating and devastating all at the same time, but just really, really beautiful investigative reporting.
Yeah. I'm from Cleveland, so I have, I'm really excited about this season for many, many reasons. I've only heard the pilot so far, but I'm so glad that I didn't like season two at all. So I'm glad that they're back with something that.
Yeah, I didn't either. I kind of trailed off with season two.
Same, same,
yeah. same.
And I really like their explanation for wanting to do something more systemic than individual and like acknowledging the sort of broader picture. So I'm really grateful. Mel, have you heard it at all yet?
No, I just realized that they came out with a third season. So I have it lined up. I just haven't listened to it. I have a feeling it's going to be kind of heavy. So just.
It is.
Yeah. Amazing. That was a great lineup. And yeah, I feel like, I don't know if I'm going to have time to read The Hate U Give before the movie comes out, but I was just sobbing in the preview the first time I saw it last weekend. So yeah. It looks super powerful in movie and book form. Well, this was so, so wonderful. I'm so grateful that we got to talk kind of in person, and I've just been admiring you from afar, and I'm so happy for all the people who will get to be at your workshop at PNCA, and I think that's it. Melody, any other final words?
Just thank you so much, and just know that I'm spreading your resources to my colleagues, and I'm sure you'll make a huge difference in our world as well, so thank you very much.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.